happily open it up for questions, and David Hernandez will have the mic. Just raise your hand for a question.
I'm not sure this is a question, but a thought that began percolating, I guess, even as early as your piece, Sam, which I loved. I loved all three of them. But at the end of Marty, of your piece, and then thinking back to Astrid's, especially that Impossible T-shirt, the image of Don Quixote began to circulate, or to canter past, never going anywhere, and being maybe more than ironic as a figure, but less than sarcastic, and thoroughly pathetic, and entirely heroic, all of those things. And then thinking about Don Quixote as an event in the formation of Spanish literary culture, and maybe Spanish culture more largely, I had the wild notion that we were witnessing in your accounts and also in what you are giving accounts of, a kind of moment of foundation of something that's going on or is about to be going on in Australian literary or aesthetic or art culture. Is that entirely insane?
And it's interesting that you mentioned Don Quixote, because in my paper, like in a draft of it, I had I had the dedication to Nixon as being a quixotic gesture, like, which I then morphed into conceptual or whatever, but yeah. And I don't know, I also associate Forbes, I guess, especially with like Tristram Shandy too, who is kind of a quixotic figure. But I haven't really read Don Quixote properly. I've only read, I guess, the first part of it. So I feel like there's something quixotic about Forbes, but I was also maybe trying to say that his self-positioning, there is a kind of sentimentality about it, which I think is limiting of other possibilities. But I don't think that really came across in my presentation exactly. But I definitely also identify with the kind of the kind of going nowhere position that Marty was trying to articulate to. Also things that Astrid said, which I can't summarize.
I was just going to say, I think definitely one of the things that I'm really interested in Pimichi's work and more broadly is this sense of ambivalence and maybe excessive irony not being counterproductive or self-negating or merely showing back the image that we know to be there of the self or the other or whatever, but actually something that is like super constructive even if not resolved. And I mean, you know, like the word proliferative from this morning is kind of like something that comes to mind in that sense. And I think what's I don't know how well I conveyed this because I kind of have really been quite agonized by the writing of this paper, but is that to say that it's kind of not doing critique in the way that we expect critique to be done, or that it's doing something that wants to, it is not that it's not doing critique, but that it's showing that critique is like inadequate unto itself when it shows what we already know to be there. And that I see as this kind of very constructive form of ambivalence. You know, and it's a conversation that goes on almost kind of like so prolifically it's exhausting, is this question of what we do about the things we know and what we do about our participation in them. And, you know, what then we have to expect from ourselves and from the aesthetics we engage with about, you know, what's going to happen in that respect. And it's hard to find language for that. I don't know how particular it is to Australianness in this sense. I think it's quite kind of endemic, but I do think that there is a, I do think that the responses to this are quite vernacular, and in that sense they can be kind of locally apparent, which I think is kind of something that connects the three examples.
May I make a follow-up comment, which is that the other part of my thought was that if it's like a Quixote figure that's moving around but not... there's the other side of this is what the poetics and the actual practices that Natalie and Allie and Pete talked about in the earlier today, which is that they're already there. Like that it's that the sort of the windmill's churning, but it's already there.
Absolutely.
Which seems like the particularly in, I don't know of any other place where that those two impulses, like what the you three have represented and then what they have represented, sort of reflect on each other without mirroring each other, but speak to each other so profoundly.
And I think that's really interesting in terms of, because I had that sense as well, and I had that sense that coming into this panel, the three of us were all very prepared to realise that our claims that we made in the titles of the papers actually that were about this kind of anti-futurity had nothing to do with anti-futurity or futurelessness, but actually was about this kind of complication of the future and the idea of the future, or its anti-future as both kind of radically negating the past, which is obviously not what, you know, like, which is so complicated, and I think that's kind of why in the end they all became actually quite futuristic rather than anti-future-ish.
I'm happy with that. I suppose I'm not sure I followed the most recent bit of this, the bit of discussion, but I think the main thing the connection that I would see is that it's from, well, it's hard to maybe just entangle, but at least nominally it's from a position of normative life. From that point of view, that you look like you're going nowhere, but maybe you don't know if you're going somewhere yourself either, or it's hard to tell because what are your criteria? And I suppose with the Indigenous writers who spoke earlier, I think that's like there is a connection with that, but I guess for them I would think they have a clear and which I wholeheartedly agree with and support, which is that there's no doubt that they are going somewhere. And that they never cease flourishing or generating, creating, and so on. And maybe, yeah, that's just a distinction. And then maybe Tim's dad is slightly more empty, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm at a comment which I feel like is maybe not going in the direction that is now going, but I feel like I'm just parodying metaphorically what we've been saying, but
that seems to fit the bill.
I mean, what seemed to me across the papers was something like after the rhetorical question or something, or doing donuts. but I just wanted to ask, you know, in lieu of something else. But what I wanted to ask Sam was whether there was something about bathos that is worth saying something about that Forbes poem about, like, permanent bathos or the pathetic field or something, and some kind of defense mechanism or something. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, that's, I mean, that's where I was. Oh,
and post-apocalyptic genre as well.
Yeah. That's what I was trying to, I guess that's what I was trying to get across, was that, like, Forbes is, well, I mean, yeah, no, I don't actually want to use the surname as a kind of like a term which resumes all the work, because what I was also discovering in my writing was that there were like a lot of different ways that this was being articulated in his work, whatever. And but there is, in that poem at least, and in other poems which you can kind of connect with that one, there is this kind of defensiveness, like, which, you know, I also don't have a judgment about that, but I thought that was also very different from some other kinds of poetics in relation to like the question of the end or like speculating about the end. And I guess, yeah, Forbes is like very speculative in that way, at least in that work. Yeah, like the way that irony and kind of warning and fear work, that is very different from, say, existing after the end and like kind of deranging scales. Like, I guess bathos requires like, you need to set up some kind of lows and highs or something in which you then deflate. Whereas I feel like, for example, in that Dee Bryant poem that I was talking about, there's a very different relationship to like scale and like height and depth or something, which is just completely different. It's, yeah. And much more active, I would say. But yeah, I don't think I really fleshed that out. I was able to catch up that argument. So.
I'll kind of try and get around to what I want to say, but I was just thinking what Astrid was saying about conspiracy as a kind of theoretical tool. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about Sam's reading of Gib Brian's poem in January. I was blown away by the audacity of it, and also thinking that it was like an example of what Astrid was talking about as conspiracy theory as a tool. Because I was looking, how did he get from the policeman's heart to the blip on the radar, except by being so immersed in this paranoid universe of the poll?
How did I get there?
Yeah.
Is that the question?
I just think there is no way that you got there. But it's like Michael Farrell poem. It's like, I'm not supposed to be doing this, but I'm doing it. So.
I mean, I think it's like a pretty... Yeah, I mean, my reading sounded very crazy, I admit, and I think generally my readings of those poems in producing this paper had an element of paranoia about them. But I don't really think there's a difference between paranoia and knowledge, firstly. I mean, I know that's also a highly dubious thing to just say, but... or, like, yeah, thought and madness maybe are not so different. Yeah, so that's kind of a cliche, but... yeah, like, if the policeman's heart is the measure of smallness, yet the cockroach is smaller than it. The policeman's heart is getting smaller, and something which comes up on a radar is a blip, right, which is a point. So a point is an infinitely small thing.
But why is the policeman's heart getting smaller?
Because, yeah, that's maybe the speculative or the crazy thing. Right? So the cockroach is smaller than a policeman's heart, which is like, that's obviously literally true, but the policeman's heart is functioning as a measure of smallness. Yeah. So like, it's like absolutely small.
I loved it. I just
like if something is, like the poem is not saying a cockroach is literally smaller than a policeman's heart, is it? Because we know that. Like because a policeman has to be a human, supposedly. And not anymore actually, but well, you know, there's robots now.
Yeah, that's in RoboCop.
Yeah, exactly. So a policeman's a human heart is a certain size, a cockroach is a certain size. Like, so it's not a literal statement about the size relationship between a cockroach and a policeman's heart. It's saying that the policeman's heart is a measure of smallness. So it has to be pretty damn small to relate to the smallness of the cockroach, I guess. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's becoming smaller, basically. Yeah, it's crazy, I guess.
It's like the poem helps you with your paranoia methods or whatever, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I found that fine. But obviously, in the paper.
Echo chamber.
I was just like, oh yeah, of course. But obviously it's like prompted by a text, which maybe you wouldn't have that thought, in other contexts.
Yeah. back there.
Thanks for those papers. I was really struck by the conversation among the three presentations about scale and power, and that's sort of where we arrived just now. Marty, I loved your words micro-indexing and micro-affirmations, and as Astrid, we had absurdly long T-shirts and kind of what you described as the humanising impulse to index internet proliferation or virality. So I'm wondering about power, political power, in the space of the speculation of scale in mediated technological environments, I guess, something along those lines, because there has to be a location of politics of scale into that internet space that you're presenting with the T-shirts, and it's infinitely indexical. And something about its capacity talks back to state power in a very interesting way. So I just wondered about those correlations.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I have a student that uses the internet as the source for a work, it's always my first comment, which is like, if this is gonna work, it has to be, you know, the scale has to be larger. You know, they, like, maybe a student will select 10 lines of something that is almost an infinite database, and my comment will always be like, this is not long enough. Which is funny, because it's kind of, it now just seems like this generic thing I say, but it does seem true. And I think that is, there's a sense in which the sort of, I don't know, it's often referred to as the like entropic level of data or whatever, it indexes so many things, like human labours and infrastructures and archives and systems, and like, you know, this speaks so much to the kind of overwhelming content of the archive that Natalie spoke about, the sort of extent of content that produces these kind of databases, which I don't really know what to say about that sort of relationship with power, other than there is something about power which is captured in that scale, and therefore something about the kind of with works of art that respond to that it's hard to both work with that scale and not merely symbolise it, or, you know, or not merely kind of represent it as a kind of fragment of this larger thing. So I think that sort of moving between the way then to show scale is through this kind of relative movement between the very kind of between the singular and that sort of infinity. But yeah, I don't know, I'm not saying anything useful here. I'm giving it up.
I'm not sure if this is like really exactly relating to scale, but I guess what I was trying to talk about in my paper was something to do with like the way that a reigning language, which seems like very titanic or monumental or also omnipresent, is also like, it's only like a fake omnipresence or something, or like its result is not yet determined, even though it continually wants to say that it's one or something like that. And I guess that kind of relates in a way to the chaotic, like, you know, if just like widely associate, like, you know, the scale of one's kind of like fearless delusions or something in as compared to like what's supposed to be true or what's supposed to be real. And yet, like, we can maybe connect that to like, you know, our associative like go nowhere kind of logics in poetics. And that, to me, I was trying to put that in relationship to like fearlessness, which would be basically a requirement of any like political move, like moving politically or being active politically, not active politically, but just moving instead of being inert and continually doing donuts. I guess relating to that, to the indigenous poetics that we were hearing about today, like, I guess, you know, we have different, I mean, I have a different experience in relation to fear, and I also have a different experience in relation to what's, you know, what truths one is like brought up in, or what truths one is like gathered into or whatever. And obviously, like, yeah, there is a thing of scale there as well, I guess.
Your point about time and anticipating what's going to happen and writing that into something that alleviates it before it comes is excellent. It's fantastic. And my quixote for you is the hacker. And it's like, my government's going to pay a better hacker than you have so that I can ward off the possibility of a super index that it does away with state power. So it's pretty, it's an interesting set of scales that aren't just about space, but they're about the temporalities that you're saying in the phrase, be alert, not alarmed.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was trying to emphasise, like, that we're being told that something is, or we're always being told that something's going to happen, therefore we should kind of, like, be normal or whatever, and... yeah, like, I mean, if you...
Or go shopping, that's what George W. Bush said after 9/11.
Yeah, yeah. So you won't, you get right.
Yeah. It's like solidarity with the NSA. Yeah. Like, keep shopping.
I think
we have
time for one
more.
Philip had a question.
So much of interest there, that panel, and I just wanted to say, you know, how impressive the ethics of your response were to the text that you were focusing on, whether it's the Art of Master's Case or Tim's poetry or the poems that Sam was looking at. That's a heartening thing to hear, I think, but the struggles with, or the grappling, Sam, with Forbes's ironies, coruscating ironies, which is, you know, I understand that entirely, that's an important thing, and it's a hard thing to do with that poetry, for example. You know, it's as if Forbes is making sure that nothing he writes can be parodied, and, you know, that means it's difficult to get a grip on it in lots of ways. Astrid, you're talking about the kind of politics of critique, I guess, art as critique or something like that, but you're not using the hermeneutics of suspicion yourself.
Mm.
You're doing something much more flexible and objective and taking a different kind of view. Marty, you too. So the kind of exemplary kind of ethical responses you're making, I think, are very impressive. But I just think that they could be facilitated more by a sort of sense of articulating your own positionality in the way you did in the comments here now, that you didn't in the actual papers themselves, which are very interesting and might be very important in terms of how you shape and how you tackle, how you grapple with those complexities that you're confronting in the arts, in the work of arts, in the text, the poems, whatever, themselves. You know, I think you can allow yourself a kind of statement of positionality, if you like, more than perhaps you're doing. I don't mean to sound like Grandpa here. You
know what I mean? No, I think that's the dream outcome of a panel, is the opportunity to have those moments in the discussion where you realise how you can then go back and revisit the paper. And I think all of us had this sort of fear of being provisional or something, which is actually a really exciting thing when that opportunity arises to kind of position oneself in the discussion. So yeah. Thank you.
I was just going to say, I think I cut out into things, probably cut out all those sorts of things. I'm not really very experienced at writing these. I mean, I write essays or something, but not this kind.
Put it back in.
And I guess I always just get caught along, like, moving with the reading that you're doing and with those thoughts, and just being, like, just barred with that. And obviously that's, like, with lacking that reflexive moment. I disagree with that.
Yeah, I was trying to structure my argument for a long time, and I basically ended up being incapable of giving it a good structure. But yeah, I had more of a theoretical part, but I was just worried about the time. Basically, like,
we did have temporal structure, though. It's like after the bombs and then January.
Yeah. It's not genuine. What else do you like? Hot and dry.
All right, well, thank you for our panelists.